This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Mordecai, Book 1 of The Riven Gates. Written by Michael G. Manning, performed by Alex Windham. Chapter 1. It was mid-afternoon by the time I walked into Camlin. It was a small village in my mind, but by most standards it was perfectly average. A communal well occupied the center space between the dwelling of its citizens. More people lived outside, of course, in the surrounding area, farmers and herders mostly. The village proper was mainly composed of the small portion of the population that made their living through trade and craft. There was a cooper, a chandler, a weaver, and a carpenter. The village wasn't quite large enough to support a smithy, which made it perfect for Tom the Tinker, I thought. Without a smith, people would be wanting their scissors and knives sharpened, their pots mended, and perhaps a bit of glue. Glue was always popular in small villages. I had other small sundries for trade as well. Salt, a few spices, several balls of twine, and a small roll of linen cloth. A tinker does well when he can anticipate the needs of those he visits. That was probably the main reason that tinkers were often associated with good luck. A tinker appears at random, always an unexpected guest, and carries with him small goods that people frequently need but are often out of. For that, we are usually welcomed with a smile. The fact that we also carry gossip and news from other places makes us almost as popular as a traveling minstrel. Almost. Again, I wished I'd learned to play an instrument, but I never had the opportunity. It might have made things easier. Glancing down, I gave myself a once-over before I approached the woman I'd spotted by the well. Appearances were important. I didn't want to give the wrong impression. My beard was of medium length, well-kept, but not overly neat. My clothes were worn and patched, but relatively clean, other than the understandable road dust. The cloth pack slung over my shoulder was in good condition, and visibly bulging with hidden treasures and unexpected surprises. I put on a friendly smile as I approached, stopping a respectful distance away. "Excuse me, madam, but is there a place hereabouts where a hungry man could get a meal? I can pay." I shook a modestly small purse, making the coins jingle to prove my words. The woman was of middling age, her features weather-worn and her hands rough from honest labor. She gave me a wary look, which was perfectly reasonable since I was a stranger. Setting down her water jar, she answered, "Harold runs the pub, such as it is." She jerked a thumb toward a modestly sized building behind her. Then her eyes lit on my pack. "Are you a tinker?" I grinned and nodded.
"Yes, ma'am, I have the honor. Folks call me Tom, Tom the Tinker. Do you have aught that needs mending?"
"I do," she replied. "My best pa's lost its handle, but I doubt you can fix it with what tools you might have carried."
"I might surprise you," I said with a chuckle. "Old Tom is known for his cleverness of fixing things. Let me take a look, and maybe there'll be something I can do for you."
The pot in question was a moderately large stew kettle made of iron. It was sturdily built, but age and metal fatigue had not been kind to the handle on one side. The metal had snapped loose where a weld had rusted over the intervening years since it had been made. It wasn't something a tinker's hammer could fix, and glue was definitely not going to do the trick. By all rights, it would need a smith with a forge and proper tools to fix.
"I think I can remedy this," I told her. "But if you let me have it this evening, I can give it back to you tomorrow."
Her eyes narrowed.
"You'd steal a woman's only good part."
"No, ma'am, I can fix it. Just trust me with it for a little while."
Suspicious, she returned.
"I don't think you can fix it with what you got. If you're still in town tomorrow, I might let you. I'll wait to see if you rob someone else first."
I sighed.
"All right, I'll visit Harold's then."
I didn't plan on staying that long, and she was clearly too wary to let a stranger have her prized pot.
"How's his food?"
"Terrible," she said, spitting on the ground. "His ale's good, but I wouldn't touch the stuff he calls meat."
Touching my hat and giving her a nod, I thanked her.
"I appreciate the advice."
Then I made my way over to Harold's pub. Unlike most taverns, it had no sign. The village wasn't quite prosperous enough for such niceties. I'd been considering whether I should knock first or simply enter, since there was no outward clue that it was a public building, but I was saved from the decision by the fact that there was no door. The entrance was filled only by a short length of dirty wool. Pushing it aside, I looked in. Two men, who were probably farmers, sat to one side of a common room that probably wouldn't hold more than 6 or 7 people at most. There was no bar, merely another table and a doorway that led to another room. This doorway was fortunate enough to have an actual door hanging in it. I nodded a greeting at the two men.
Evening.
They nodded back, but said nothing. As I took a seat at the other table, one of them barked,
Hey, Harold, you got another customer?
I gave the farmer a thankful look, since I hadn't known the proper etiquette for the establishment. After a moment, a large man with a balding pate peeked through the doorway. He grinned when he saw me, displaying a wide mouth that was missing several teeth.
Hello, what can I get you?
Following the woman's advice, I answered,
Just a cup of ale, and maybe a place to rest for the night.
Are you looking to,
he said,
but I don't have beds for travelers. This is just a simple tavern, not an inn.
Just ale, then.
Harold left, and a moment later came back with a large clay cup filled to the brim. He placed it in front of me, and then helped himself to a chair.
What news from the road? He asked.
I took a sip, and found that the woman's advice was sound. The ale was solid. When traveling, you never knew what you'd find. I wondered at the contrast, though. Good ale, but bad food, at least if the rest of her council was to be believed. Was it simply that Harold cared more about drink than cooking? From the size of his belly, it was hard to believe.
They're opening a magical road in Hallam, I told him.
No,
exclaimed Harold.
Are you sure?
They were breaking ground on the foundation when I passed through, I replied.
That was simple truth, and I had indeed seen it with my own eyes.
That never would have happened if Darrigan was still king,
Harold expounded in a sage voice. The two farmers were leaning over, listening carefully to our words. News was a highly valued commodity, and in some cases you could even trade it for food. I might have traded for the ale, but since I didn't mind paying, I hadn't bothered.
The new king seems to favor a more open relationship with Lothian, I observed.
They named one already.
Harold's eyes were wide. I took another sip and nodded.
Mm-hmm. Just last week, the lords met and proclaimed Gerald the Baron of Ingerhold to be the new king.
Harold frowned.
A baron?
He wasn't familiar with the name, but it seemed strange to him that a mere baron had been named.
Duke Anselm had the best claim, I clarified, but he renounced his claim in favor of Ingerhold. Apparently the baron was a great hero in the battle and made a great name for himself with the people. The lords declared for him unanimously. I'm surprised you hadn't heard about it already.
One of the farmers piped up.
We haven't seen any travelers in weeks.
Harold was more interested in the magic road, though, so he returned to the topic.
I'm not so sure this road thing is a good idea for Dunbar.
I raised my brows.
How so? Everyone stands to profit from the increased trade. Trade is well and all, but I don't see how it will do us folk much good. The lords will take most of the harvest, and they'll make a tidy profit from it, but won't be much of it going into our pockets, said Harold.
You run a tavern, I countered.
More trade ought to mean more people coming to boy ale, especially since it's a good brew.
I took a long swallow to show my appreciation. I grunted.
I'm proud of the ale, but my customers are all farmers, like Tad and Lumley there.
He jerked his head in the direction of the other two men, who smiled back at us vaguely.
They ain't gonna see much profit from it, so I won't neither. Other men get rich, but common folk like us don't see much of it from down here at the bottom of the barrel.
Sadly, I couldn't fault his logic. And I made a mental note of it. A word in the right ear might do them some good. The conversation went on for an hour or more, and then I offered to sharpen his knives. Harold accepted and paid me with another 2 cups of ale. Afterward, he offered me a suggestion.
As I said before, I don't offer beds, but if you need a place to sleep, Widow Timley has extra room, and I'm sure she needs the coin. She might even have something that needs attention.
The tone in his voice made it clear that he was suggesting I might be able to share the widow's bed instead of sleeping alone. It was a crude remark and would have earned scorn in more polite company, but behind his words I could sense something else. Was it concern? It gave me the impression that perhaps he genuinely hoped I would hit it off with the woman. If she was indeed a widow, then she might be in need of help. A woman living alone faced many challenges, of which financial support was only one, and not necessarily the most important.
In any case, it sounds better than sleeping on the ground or in someone's shed, I agreed.
He gave me directions to her home, which was easy to find, since it was just outside the center of the tiny village. I gathered up my pack and made my way. Of course I had no intention of trying to inveigle the woman into sharing her charms with me. I was married, but Harold hadn't known that. It was rare for a travelling tinker to have a family, after all. I considered not bothering her, since I didn't really need a place to sleep, but something made me call out anyway.
Hello? Mrs. Timley? Harold at the tavern said I should ask if you might have a bed I could use. I don't mind paying.
It was a small house, so I had no doubt she would be able to hear me, and I already knew she was inside. After a moment, she looked out the door at me. She said nothing for a long minute while she sized me up. For a woman living alone, a strange man, or any man, was a risk to bring into her home. In higher circles, it was unheard of. But here, among the peasants of Dunbar, the practicalities of survival were more important. Being a widow, and with no prospect for a new husband, she had little to fear from developing a reputation as a loose woman. She had much more to gain from my coin. I was surprised by her age. She was awfully young to be a widow. At a guess, I would have placed her age in the late 20s or early 30s. Dark brown hair peeked out from the edges of the cloth covering her head, and her looks were marred only by a bend in her nose. It had probably been broken at one time and had healed poorly. Finally, she answered.
Come in.
Stepping back, she let the door swing wide. Something about the plain response bothered me. She should have been more suspicious, asked a few questions, or given me a warning. Assuming she was only hoping to sell me a place to sleep for the night, that is. Her response didn't make sense if she were actually a wanton woman either. She would have put on some false charm if that were the case. No, this was the empty response of a woman who simply didn't care anymore. Thank you, ma'am, I replied, entering the house. How much will you take for the bed?
What can you pay?
She said, returning the question. There's 2 pennies enough, I asked. I honestly wasn't certain, but I guessed it was an appropriate amount. She shrugged.
That's fine.
The room was small, and while it wasn't quite nice enough to call cozy, snug would do for a description. It appeared well kept for a villager of small means. A pot hung over the fire, and a chair was drawn up before it. The smell coming from it was tempting, far better than the odors in Harold's tavern.
The bed's in there,
she said, pointing to the only other door leading from the room, which meant it was probably her bedroom.
Oh, I couldn't take your bed, ma'am,
I told her, removing my hat and assuming an humble expression. The floor in here will do me just as well. At last her features shifted slightly, showing mild surprise as she arched one brow.
You paid for a bed. I can sit by the fire tonight.
The words brought me a sense of mild relief. She was definitely not offering herself for the evening.
No, ma'am, I'm not used to a bed. The fire's enough and my pack will make a fine pillow.
Both statements were pure lies. I hadn't slept on the ground in years, and I was pretty sure the pack I carried would leave me with a cramped neck if I tried to use it in such a manner.
Suit yourself,
she said, her features regaining their former blandness.
I was about to have supper. Did Harold feed you?
Now this was a quandary. I hadn't intended on eating, but it was perhaps a chance to talk to her for a while. I decided I could deal with the consequences later. I gave her a broad grin.
A lady by the well warned me about his food, so I'm still a bit peckish.
That was an understatement. I hadn't eaten since breakfast. She went to a well-made cupboard and opened it, taking out 2 wooden bowls. Whoever had furnished her home had been good with his hands. She ladled each of them full and handed one to me, then went to fetch a couple of wooden spoons. There was only 1 chair, so I crossed my legs and sat on the floor before she could offer it to me. My nose had already decided the stew would be worth eating. Looking down on me, she frowned.
I was going to offer you the chair.
That's all right, ma'am.
I punctuated the answer by shoveling in the first bite and promptly burned my tongue. As I huffed and blew, trying to cool my mouth, a faint smile crossed her lips. Then she sat down. She blew on her first bite carefully before depositing it in her mouth.
You have a nice home, I said, while waiting for my next spoonful to cool down. I can see some care went into it.
She stared into her bowl.
That was Dan. He didn't do anything by halves. Took his time.
It's more than that, I suggested. I can see your hand in it, too.
Maybe,
was all she said. We ate in silence for a while then, but when I was almost finished, I put in,
The stew was wonderful. Best meal I've had in ages.
That was a half-truth. The stew was excellent, but I was no stranger to good food.
Better than what Harold serves up, that's for sure, she said with a snort. That would be better still, but I'm running short on salt and other things. I've had to be more frugal since.
Her words ran dry. That was cruel, but I wanted to know more, so I finished the sentence for her.
Since you lost your husband?
Yeah.
If you don't mind my asking, what happened?
Hallam, was her response.
Understanding struck me then. He must have been in the capital when the recent civil war had taken place. Not that it had really been such, but it was the best description anyone had found for it.
He worked in the city.
She shook her head.
No, he was just making a delivery. Rotten luck was all it was, being there on the wrong day.
I didn't say anything for a while after that, until after she'd taken up the bowls and cleaned them. She put them away carefully, and then made her way toward the bedroom door. She started to bid me good night when I interrupted her on impulse.
What's your name?
She gave me a severe look.
I'm not looking for a new husband.
Asking her first name was an unwelcome attempt to cross into more familiar terms. I held up my hands.
I didn't mean anything by that. You just seemed like a nice lady. Thought I'd ask.
Her shoulders relaxed, and then she opened the door and stepped inside. Before it closed, I caught her reply.
Suzanne?
Good night, Suzanne, I said, unsure if she would hear me through the door.
I waited half an hour before I checked on her. I wanted to be sure she was in her bed before I did anything, but by the same token, I didn't want to accidentally observe her undressing. It was a matter of respect, though she would never have known if I had watched her preparing for sleep.
Could have been the world's greatest peeping Tom, I thought to myself,
then chuckled at the irony since I'd assumed the name Tom the Tinker. She appeared to be sleeping in the bed, but I wanted to be sure, so I softly whispered a word.
Shabal.
The spell would ensure that whether she'd been asleep initially or not, she wouldn't wake up for at least an hour. Then I released my illusion with a sigh of relief. My worn clothes vanished, replaced by supple black hunting leathers. A simple knife at my waist was now a masterful dagger, produced by one of the finest smiths in Albemarle and adorned with the emblem of my family, a gold hawk set in maroon enamel with a gold border around it. The enchantment on it was of my own devising, of course. The edge was sharper than any razor, and it never dulled. Opening the door to Suzanne's bedroom, I went in and sat down beside her. With my spell upon her, she never stirred.
You're a good woman, Suzanne, I told her, and I'm sorry for what happened to your husband. It's a shame that such things happen in this world.
She couldn't hear me, of course, but I felt the need to say it anyway. After all, what had happened to her husband was partly my family's fault. I repeated the sleeping spell, sending her into a deeper unconsciousness, and then I pulled back the blankets that covered her. She'd worn a gown to bed, so she wasn't naked, but I could feel the heat radiating from her body. Perhaps heat wasn't the right word. It was her life force, her aether, the living energy that everyone possessed. As always, it called to me, tempting me, and I felt the old hunger once again. That was something I had never told anyone about. My deepest shame. I had once merged my soul with the Shigreth and become the void itself. I'd overcome it and regained my humanity, but it had left its mark on me, and I could still hear it singing to me when my attention wavered. Sometimes I awoke at night having dreamed I was one of them again, and even after waking I could feel its cold chill, not from some external source, but from within. I always felt it near the dying, but sometimes, like now, it was the supple health of the living that reminded me. The woman beneath my gaze had awoken the hunger in me this time. Pushing my dark thoughts aside, I reached down and slid my hand over her hip. Sending my mage sight inward, I searched until I found what I'd spotted earlier. Suzanne had possessed a slight limp when she walked, the product of some accident in her past. How she'd broken her hip was not my business, but it had healed improperly. Reaching behind her head, I numbed the nerves that reported the sensations of her body to her brain, and then I used my power to carefully break her hip again in two places. With that done, I realigned the bones and fused them back together. She would have some soreness from it tomorrow, but that would pass, and when it had, she would find her limp gone. Next, I numbed the nerves that led to her nose, and then I corrected it as well. Years earlier, I had learned by painful trial and error that those nerves didn't travel through the spine like almost all the others did. It wasn't the sort of mistake one makes twice. After I finished, I gave her an appraising look. She'd been a lovely woman before, but without the crooked nose, she would be a real beauty. Not that she wasn't already, but perhaps life would be kinder to her now. I couldn't control the future, though. There would be no telling what the future might bring her, whether fortune or more sorrow. I hoped it would be the former. I imagined that her face would swell while it healed, and I wondered what curses she might wish upon me when she awoke. She probably wouldn't realize the extent of what I'd done until her nose returned to its normal size again. Replacing the bed linens, I tucked her in carefully, as I might have done for one of my own children. Then I left and closed the door quietly behind me. Back in the main room, I collected my pack and left a selection of coins on the table. It was far more than the 2 pennies I'd promised her, but not so much as to cause her trouble. The walk back into town was a short one, and once there, I visited the home of the woman I'd met at the well. I put her and the rest of her family to sleep before I entered. Inside, I took a moment to find the broken pot, and, using a spell, I welded the handle firmly back on. It was a silly gesture, perhaps, but I felt better for doing it. Her home was not as nice as Suzanne's had been, so I left a few coins in the pot and placed it on the table in the front room, being careful not to step on any of her sleeping children who were bedded down around it. Then I left and made my way into the forest, traveling without light. A wizard rarely needed light to find his way. Once I'd gotten far enough, I drew a piece of cloth out of my pack and rolled it out onto the bare ground. It had the design for a teleportation circle painted on it. Using another spell, I copied the design onto the earth below. When I lifted the cloth again to pack it away, there was a circle made purely of light superimposed on the ground. It was an idea I had had only recently, but it made creating new circles a much quicker task. I only needed to add the keys to it, and it would be ready for use. I did that using a silver stylus plucked from the pouch at my waist. The main disadvantage was that the circle would only last a matter of minutes. It would fade shortly after I'd left, but that was perfect for my purpose. I preferred not to leave any evidence of my passing behind me. Stepping into the circle, I prepared to teleport myself home, then paused for a second. What was I going to tell Penny? I was returning later than I'd promised, and even worse, I'd already eaten. I patted my belly. It was a little larger than it had been in my younger days. There's probably room in there for seconds, I announced to the trees. If I ate enough, perhaps you wouldn't realize I'd committed culinary infidelity. Chapter 2. She was waiting for me when I got home. Not right inside the door, but with my mage sight I saw her head turn when I stepped inside. The dragon bond gave my wife exceptional hearing, among other things. Penelope Alluniel was sitting in the family room, a cup of tea beside her and a book in her hand. She wasn't one for staying up late, as I was, so I knew she was waiting for me. Tossing my hat on the hall tree, I hung up my coat and proceeded in to greet her. "You're late," she said, not looking up from her book. "Sorry about that," I apologized. She kept her eyes on the page. "I cooked, too." I winced. I'd expected that, but it still made me feel bad. Being the Countess de Cameron meant that my wife didn't often get the chance to cook at home, as most women did. What for them was a daily chore was for her a lucky chance, especially since all our children were home again. "I'm still hungry," I lied. She glanced up at me.
"It's cold now."
"Cold or hot, I love everything you make," I answered.
"Liar," she replied. "You don't like my mince pies."
I shrugged. "Well, fair enough, but I don't like anyone's mince pies, so I don't count them." She started to rise.
"I'll make you a plate."
Motioning for her to stay seated, I headed for the kitchen. "I'll get it, dear. You stay there and I'll join you."
"Bring me another cup of tea then," she told me. "There's a kettle on the stove already."
It took me several minutes to assemble a respectable plate of food that I thought I could finish. The tea steeped while I did that, and before I brought it all back into the family room, I crammed my mouth full of ham. Hopefully she would think I had been eating while in the kitchen, which would help explain why my plate wasn't as full as usual. I returned, juggling my plate and 2 cups of tea, hers and mine.
"Here you are, sweetheart," I said, trying to talk around the food in my mouth.
"Thank you, Mort," she said, taking the cup from me. "You don't have to pretend you're starving, though. I already know you ate somewhere."
I gave her a blank look.
"What makes you say that?"
She tapped her nose. The goddamn dragon bond. I should have known. It didn't just improve her hearing, but all her senses, as well as granting her extraordinary strength and speed. The Countess de Cameron was one of the deadliest warriors in Castle Cameron, though she was disarmingly beautiful.
"I smelled the stew as soon as you walked in," she explained. "What was it? Lamb?"
I thought it was rabbit, but she was probably right. "I'm not certain," I admitted. "I didn't want to eat it, but I needed an excuse to keep the cook talking."
She laughed. "I highly doubt that. You've rarely met a dish you didn't want to devour."
"Well, it smelled good. But I had a good idea you'd be cooking tonight, and nothing holds a candle to one of your meals," I replied. That wasn't strictly true either. Penny was an exceptional cook, but Castle Cameron boasted an exceptional staff, including its cooks. While I honestly did prefer her food in the main, I couldn't claim that she was always superior to the professionals who fed everyone.
"You are a wicked man, Mordecai O'Lineal," she replied with a twinkle in her eye. "Every time you speak, you try to butter me up with that silver tongue."
I answered while chewing a large piece of bread that would probably have been much better 2 hours earlier. "That's how I got 4 children.
Penny raised one brow. "I only gave you 3. How did your tongue manage the 4th?
My oldest daughter, Moira, was adopted. We had raised her as a twin to our son, who was biologically of an identical age. I talked Moira Sentir into entrusting me with her daughter, didn't I?
I suppose you're right," said Penny. "What did your glib tongue earn you tonight, besides a bowl of lamb stew?"
It might have been a jealous inquiry if it had come from another woman. My wife wasn't a jealous sort, though. She had her faults, but jealousy wasn't among them. Penny's biggest flaw was her constant fear for the safety of her family. In the last year, she'd become even more overprotective. I couldn't say it was paranoia, though. She had every reason to fear. Over the past few months, I'd been kidnapped, and both of her oldest children had gone missing while trying to find me. All of us had been marked by the experiences as well. Our daughter Moira was dealing with a wound that had left a darkness in her soul, while our son Matthew had lost his left hand. To top it all off, those events had happened shortly after our youngest daughter had been kidnapped and one of our closest servants murdered. We'd also been through some extreme events in our younger days, but while our children were growing up, we'd managed to create a relatively safe and secure environment for them. Our home had been a closely guarded secret, located deep in the Elantir Mountains and accessible only through an enchanted portal in Castle Cameron. Since Irene's kidnapping, that security was in doubt. A lot more people knew where we lived. No, I couldn't blame my wife for her anxiety. She had every reason to worry. "Not much," I answered, "other than a few cups of ale. So far I haven't found any sign of Ansis in the villages closest to Hallam."
"How long are you going to keep searching?" she asked. "We've already done a lot for Dunbar. It shouldn't be your responsibility to keep everyone in the world safe."
"Well, there's no one else to do it," I replied. "From what Matthew and Moira learned, if those things take hold somewhere and no one notices, it could be too late by the time they get to us. It's not just their safety, it's everyone's."
Penny sighed.
"What?"
"It's always the same, isn't it?"
"What is?"
She waved her hand. "First it was the Shigreth and Gododin and the Dark Gods, and now it's this Ansis thing. When will it end?"
"At least it's just one enemy this time."
"Sure it is," she replied. "You know better than that. We have more enemies than most nations ever managed to earn. Most of the nobility of Lothian secretly despise us. The only reason they haven't done anything is because they're scared to death of you. Even the Queen, your cousin, doesn't trust us."
"That's not fair," I told her. "Ariadne loves me, and I'm sure she trusts you."
"Clever, Mort. You skirt the truth with facts. Yes, she loves you. In fact, she almost sees you as a brother since you and Mark were so close, but she doesn't trust you. And maybe she does trust me, but it's only in the sense that she hopes I can keep you under control."
"I can live with that."
"You have to," said Penny. "Back to the topic at hand. Since you didn't find our elusive enemy, what did you do all day in the hinterlands of Dunbar?"
I smiled. "Well, I was disguised as Tom the Tinker, so I mended a few things. I made a wonderful repair of an iron pot. It's better than new, I think."
"And in trade, the lady gave you some of her stew?" asked Penny.
"The stew came from a different lady," I said. "But what makes you assume it was a woman?" Penny smirked.
"You'd have mentioned the cook before now if it had been a man. Was she pretty?"
"Not half so lovely as you," I returned immediately. Her eyes widened.
"Oh, so she was gorgeous."
"She would have to be half as lovely as you. That's a given," I replied. "Besides, her nose was all bent and crooked." Penny's intuition was once again too good.
"You didn't. Now you're jumping to conclusions," I said.
No, I'm not, insisted Penny. That's why you're late. I know you only have to walk through a town to tell if people have those things in them. You stayed to fix that woman's nose.
I let my shoulders droop in defeat, and I mended a pot. Also, she had a limp. Her frown was all for me.
We've talked about this.
I felt bad. She lost her family in Hallam. We're partly to blame for that.
We didn't bring those monsters to Hallam. We got rid of them. Whatever happened, they can't lay it at our feet. You can't fix everyone, Mort. Why do you do this to yourself?
Said Penny. She took my plate from my hands and drew me to my feet. Then she wrapped her arms around me.
It's not all your fault. None of this is. But you still act like it's your job to fix everything.
I know that, I said irritably. Her hair smelled nice, so I laid my head on her shoulder.
What's going to happen if someone finds out you've been sneaking around healing people? Asked Penny.
It's not a crime, I protested. Someone said it's a nice thing to do.
Yes, it's nice, but that's not the point. People know you're a wizard, and the people of Washbrook know you can heal some things. With just that little bit, we've constantly got people coming to the door seeking your aid. If they find out just how much you can do, we'll never have any peace. Right now it's just a broken bone or minor wounds, but if people know you can fix bent noses or straighten a lame leg, you see where that would lead, don't you? People will be coming from everywhere, wanting you to heal all manner of sicknesses and infirmities.
There's a lot of things I can't fix, I corrected her.
They won't know that, argued Penny, but when you tell them, they'll blame you for withholding your gift. You've been blamed for too many things that weren't your fault already. Don't let them add this burden to your shoulders.
I nodded. You make a lot of sense. That's why I always keep myself disguised. She nipped my ear.
Stupid never dies.
Now you're using my own words against me.
Am I wrong? She said with a smile.
Then she pulled away.
Let's go to bed. It's late.
I followed her, giving her derriere a firm squeeze as we went.
Don't get any ideas, she told me. I'm not in the mood tonight.
Damn it. As always, the world slowly began to intrude upon me the next morning. But I was warm, and the bed was comfortable, so I ignored it. Mornings were simultaneously my favorite and most loathed time of day. I suppose it depended on the circumstances that surrounded any given morning, but one thing was certain, it was all or nothing. The good mornings involved me slowly waking up, usually with Penny close by. Those mornings were soft and fuzzy, full of the appreciation one has for a warm bed and nothing pressing to do. They were filled with the scent of my lovely wife's hair, the warmth of her back close against me, and, if I was really lucky, an adventuresome frolic before we faced the rest of the world. Other mornings were not so kind. No, that was an understatement. The other kind of morning was a misery that deserved to die a cold death. They were composed of a rapid start, urgent events, cold floors and bare feet, or given my uncertain life, sometimes danger. If anything, my greatest goal in life was maximizing the number of good mornings I encountered and minimizing the other kind. Today, I was hoping for the good kind. I had every reason to expect one. I had gone to bed at a not-too-late hour with my best friend beside me and nothing dangerous on the horizon. Those were all good indicators. However, there were other variables that were always uncertain. Primarily, what sort of wakening did my wife have? Some days she woke up and attacked the day with a ferocity that I had no desire to share. Those days fell firmly in my to-be-avoided-at-all-costs category, for they usually involved her trying to force me up at some ungodly hour, often using tactics that were cruel and uncalled for. My mage sight wasn't functioning yet. I slept with my mind closed since it was safer. It wasn't a guarantee that my archmage abilities wouldn't get me into trouble, but it seemed to minimize the risk. Rather than open my arcane senses, I decided to discover the morning more slowly. Reaching across the bed, I found Penny's thigh close by, warm and soft. That's a good sign, I thought, inching a little closer to her. Something whimpered. That set me back. Whimpering was not on my list of expected morning events. I cracked one lid open slightly, just in time to catch something warm and wet, which made my face scrunch up as my eye closed firmly. What the hell? I reopened my mage sight while simultaneously wiping my face and looking through my fingers. A small furry animal was lying between me and Penny. Isn't he cute? Penny cooed. Obviously, she'd been waiting for me to wake up. It was a puppy. its short tail curled over its back as it wiggled and tried to lick my face again. Valiantly, I defended myself while trying to sit up. If there was to be any frolicking this morning, it would be of an entirely different sort than I'd hoped. "Where did this come from?" I asked.
She smiled. "It was a gift from the new King of Dunbar. Isn't he adorable?"
"He's something, all right," I agreed.
"Pick him up. He wants you to love on him,"
she commanded. And yes, it was a command. Don't ever let women fool you. When they tell you to pet or snuggle with something, it's very much an order. To not do so would see you labeled a grump or something similarly unsavory. Feigning weak enthusiasm, I lifted the puppy to my chest and stroked his head, all the while considering what sort of punishment I could visit on Gerald Ingerhold of Dunbar. He'd obviously done this with some malign intent to disrupt my quiet household. I was rewarded with more licking and a warm sensation spreading across my chest.
"Oh my," giggled Penny. "He peed on you."
I gave her my best long-suffering look. "Well, that's what babies do, isn't it? Why don't you give me a hug?" I leaned toward her with a wicked gleam in my eye. Penny was too quick. She was up and out of the bed before I could complete the gesture.
"Maybe after you change your shirt."
Sighing, I gave the puppy a serious look. "You don't want me to change my shirt, do you?"
"His name is Humphrey," said Penny.
Life was perfect. I'd only recently been lamenting that my kids were all too old to pee on people anymore. Now we had a dog. "That's the best name you could come up with?" I asked.
"Moira liked it," explained my wife. "I know you weren't expecting this, but she does love animals. I'm hoping he'll help her."
"She can make magic dogs with just a thought," I argued. "Dogs that can talk and don't pee on anyone."
"It isn't the same thing at all," said Penny.
She was probably right. Seeing little Humphrey on the floor, I removed my nightshirt and used my power and some water from the wash basin to rinse my chest. Humphrey watched without comment. That done, I headed for the door. "Come on, Humphrey, let's get some breakfast." The puppy waddled a few feet and then sat down, emitting a yip of mild distress. Apparently, he wasn't up to speed on the art of following someone yet. I went back and picked him up. "Obviously, you've got some things to learn," I told him. "And if you're smart, you'll pay attention to me. The women around here will teach you all sorts of bad habits."
"Too bad," said Penny. "You're supposed to inspect the progress on the gatehouse in Hallam today. Humphrey will have to stay here and learn tricks from the girls."
I hadn't wanted to remember that. Chapter 3 Getting to Dunbar wasn't that difficult anymore, thanks to the World Road. After my daughter had started a rebellion and gotten their machine-possessed king killed, the new king had been of a different mind when it came to opening up to the world. Of course, she'd almost single-handedly gotten him made king, so perhaps he felt he owed her a few favors. In any case, Dunbar had agreed to allow me to open one of the gateways from the World Road near their capital city of Hallam. It was a good deal all around. The gateways made it easy for farmers and traders to sell their wares across widely scattered locations around Lothian, Gododdin, and now Dunbar. Prosperity was an inevitable result. There were precautions, of course. One of the big selling points of my design was security. Most of the World Road itself was underground, near Lothian, and guarded by a massive fortification. From a central location within the structure, any of the 23 gates, not all of them were in use yet, could be closed at a moment's notice. If the command was given, a massive monolith of stone driven by one of my enchantments would slide down, sealing the entrance. Those stones were designed to be unstoppable, and as far as I knew they were. One of them had killed my best friend, Dorian Thornbear. It was something I tried hard not to think about every time I stepped onto the underground road. Not only were the gates able to be sealed, but the road itself was a circle, and it could be divided into sections, each able to be sealed should an invader manage to make it past one of the gateways. Once closed, the road could be flooded via an enchanted gate that led to a portal I'd placed in the ocean. If that wasn't sufficient, my last failsafe was even more severe. Another ring gate led to an underground magma reservoir. If that one were used, the World Road would reach the end of its functional lifespan. After a life filled with danger, I had become a cautious man. Of course, as I had later learned, too much caution can be a trap as well. My design, my failsafes, all had been used in an attempt to kill my family, and only the sacrifice made by my best friend had saved them. "Damn it," I swore, wiping at my cheeks. "I wasn't going to think about that." It happened every time I walked the World Road. Being underground, one might expect it to be dark, but it wasn't. It was brightly lit, almost cheerful. I had included enchanted ceiling lights in the design. I passed several wagons on the road as I walked, nodding to the drivers. They had no idea who I was, of course. As a matter of course, I always travelled incognito. An illusion was a handy tool for that. Today, I was a grey-bearded farmer, or perhaps a craftsman. I would remove the illusion once I arrived at my destination, becoming once again the handsome and well-dressed Count Decameron. I would only need the disguise for perhaps a quarter of an hour. The transfer house in Castle Cameron had a circle that led directly to the main tower situated within the World Road. Once there, I had only to descend a multitude of stairs and then walk a quarter mile or so of the road itself until I reached the new gate that led to Hallam. At some point in the past, Penny had argued with me about travelling without guards, but I had prevailed upon her that I was safer disguised than alone. I didn't really even need the disguise. I just disliked all the bowing and formalities that inevitably ensued when people recognized me. I paused as I passed the gate that led to Lancaster. Dorian's Gate, as it was now called. I hadn't had to issue an official decree. People had just started calling it that. And well they should, I thought sadly. As always, I looked up, staring at the triangular edge that composed the bottom of the monolith that had crushed my friend. It was unmarked, its integrity unquestioned. Even my best friend's diamond body hadn't been able to scratch it. There had been some white dust there once, remnants of his body after the gate had crushed it. But even that was gone now. Legends had grown up about the event. Sometimes they called him the Diamond Knight, but mostly they just called him Dorian the Adamant. Ballads and epic sagas had been composed in his honor. He'd held the gate up for several minutes, while his wife, children, and my family had escaped through it, until it had crushed him into diamond dust and gravel. That he had done so still made me marvel. The stone that comprised the gate weighed thousands of tons, and it had behind it the force of an enchantment powered by the Godstone. I shouldn't have been able to hold it that long. But he did. Fuck me. I should have gone the other way around. It was a longer walk, but I never went that direction. I came this way to remember, or perhaps to punish myself. He had been there when I should have been. Stupid never dies, I thought. But Dorian certainly had. He lived on in the hearts and minds of people across the kingdom, in songs and stories. He'd become a legend. Well, in all honesty, so had I, but mine was a much darker sort of legend. In some parts of the world I was called the Blood Lord, mostly because of what had happened in the Duchy of Tremont. Thousands had died there, their souls devoured, and their bodies left to rot. The bodies were long gone, but men still feared to live there, though the land was fertile and vacant. I hadn't actually been the one who sent the Shigreth there. That had been my spell twin. But I had his memories. I remembered ordering it. I felt the guilt. And all I had gotten for it was a brief flogging. I'd also paid a fortune in gold to the families of those that were murdered. That still felt like an empty gesture to me. In places with kinder words for me, I was called the Godslayer, but that was the most complimentary thing anyone ever managed to say. There was still fear in the eyes of anyone who realized who I was. The only exceptions were my family members, and most of the people who lived in Washbrook or the castle proper. Aunt Penny wondered why I preferred to travel disguised. I wasn't afraid of being attacked. I was afraid of being recognized. I couldn't bear the sight of fear, loathing, and disgust that I saw in the faces of those around me. Penny saw it differently, and she was firmly convinced that if people knew the truth, they would see it the same way. But I knew the truth, and if Penny knew it, she would have been afraid of me too. I had seen the void, touched it, and returned. And some part of it still existed inside of me. Archmages were special. We could hear the voices of things that no one else could. The earth, the wind, the sea, anything, really. We could listen, become, and direct those things in a way that was wholly different from normal wizardry. But those things left an impression on us. I was the only one who had ever heard the voice of the void. And I still heard it. It whispered to me in the dark at night. It haunted my dreams when I slept. It called to me from the lips of the elderly and the dying. Sometimes I could even feel it in small children. The best times were at home with my family, I could forget in the midst of my children's chaos or when Penny smiled amidst the laughter and the smell of dinner. At those times, I felt whole again. Shaking off the dark thoughts, I kept walking, and soon the gateway to Hallam loomed ahead to my left. It hadn't been hard to activate. The world road was built with 23 gates. I had only to construct the other side and link it to this one. What was taking more time was completing the security construction for Dunbar's side. In order to allay the fears of the nations and cities that had accepted one of the gates, each was built with fortifications on both sides. This allowed each city to close their side if they felt the need. Every gate had a gatehouse at its destination, though in truth, some of them were closer to full-blown fortresses. I stepped through into brilliant sunshine, dropping my illusion and squinting to shield my eyes as I emerged from the more modest lighting of the world road. Workmen were everywhere around me. Most of them were stonemasons, but carpenters and blacksmiths were present as well, not to mention a multitude of apprentices and unskilled laborers. With my illusion gone, my black leather garb was on full display. It was an outfit that I'd made when I faced trial for my crimes after the war with the Shigreth and the gods, dark and shining. The leather was soft and supple, tooled with runes for protection. But what made it so fearsome was the design and the colors, black and red, with no allowance for the maroon and gold of House Cameron. The coat had an aggressive cut, trimmed with a red meant to remind the viewer of fresh blood. If men wanted to call me the Bloodlord, I had determined to look the part. I never wore it at home or in Washbrook. My people still loved me in the main, but for the rest of the world, the outfit was a symbol that said, "Go to hell." Being an amiable man, people had underestimated me for most of my life. These days, my reputation made that unlikely, but sometimes my smile and easy words made them forget. The clothes were a reminder. Since we were at peace, and I was no longer a criminal, Penny generally disapproved of my choice in attire. But here I was, wearing it anyway. Did I mention that I'm stubborn? Angus McElroy spotted me and came over. He was my man, a master mason by trade. He'd been with me a long time, and now made his home in Washbrook. In short, he wasn't afraid of me, like most of those around me were.
"My lord," he said, dipping his head almost casually, "I see you wore your finest again."
He was in charge of the building efforts, and his men watched him, wondering if he would be punished for his familiar attitude. I stared at them until they noticed my eyes on them and looked away, afraid of meeting my gaze. We walked a short distance away, and he gave me an exasperated look.
"Do you have to do that every time?"
"Do what?"
"Frighten them. They'll be telling stories to scare each other tonight," he answered.
My walk down memory lane had left me feeling cranky, and a lot of thoughts passed through my mind. I'd overthrown a tyrant, made a good man king, defeated an army of the dead, fought every god known, and helped resurrect a dead race. And after it all, the world had turned its back on me. Actually, it had turned my back on it and put a set of bloody stripes across my shoulders. I still bore the scars as a reminder. If I had had my way, the County Cameron would be an isolated nation, and the world could go hang, but it was forever drawing me back. None of this was Dunbar's fault, of course. In truth, it was no one's fault. But I was cranky and in no mood to be reasonable. "History has painted me as a devil, Angus. I only do my best to live up to the part." He sighed. "How goes the work?" I asked.
"It's a lot easier than that dam you and your dad had me build," he said with a chuckle.
Another bad memory, though Angus probably thought it would make me laugh. My father was dead, and while remembering him no longer hurt, what I had done with the dam was another stain on my soul. I'd used it to drown an army of 30,000. People like Angus didn't see it that way. To them, it had been an act of heroism, but then they didn't have the blood of a generation on their hands. I gave him a faint smile anyway. It wouldn't do any good to tell him any of that. Angus was a decent man, and he was doing excellent work, as always. "Do you need anything?" I asked him, cutting to the heart of the matter.
"Well?"
Of course he did. That was the nature of major construction projects. I trusted Angus to get things done properly and without waste, either time or materials. He trusted me to ensure that he got what he needed to do the job. As he talked, I made mental notes. I didn't need paper. My freakishly perfect memory did the trick. Later, I would send orders to Albemarle to have what he needed shipped to him through the world road. It made so many things easier these days. Angus looked nothing like my father, but something about him reminded me of him. Something about every craftsman I met reminded me of my father in some way. The pragmatism, concrete thinking, and no-nonsense attitude that had been so central to Royce Eldridge was present to some degree in almost every man who worked with his hands for a living. As always, I wished I'd been more like him. My father's birthday had been just 6 days ago, and something at the back of my mind niggled at me about that, something I should remember. That was the problem with memory, perfect or otherwise. I could recall anything once I knew what I was trying to recall, but sometimes you just didn't know what you needed to remember. I pushed it aside. Whatever it was would come to me later, probably while I was moving my bowels. Most important things popped into my head then. Angus was still talking. I returned my attention to him. He was waiting for a reply. Mentally, I reviewed what he had said since I hadn't been listening fully. His last question had been, "Is something wrong? You seem distracted." Nodding, I answered, "I was just thinking that I may have eaten too much for breakfast." He grinned.
"The latrines are over there if you need them."
He pointed in the direction of the makeshift wooden building they had built for the purpose. "I'm not quite ready yet," I told him. "Maybe after I get to Albemarle and order what you need."
"The road you built is changing the world," he said. "I can work here for 10 hours and then take a crap in any of a dozen cities at the end of the day if I want to."
Angus laughed to punctuate his joke. The thought of walking past Dorian's gate again wasn't pleasant. "I think I'll fly today," I told him. The mason frowned.
"Even flying, it's hundreds of miles from here to the capital."
Shaping my aether, I slowly lifted myself from the ground.
"When I put my mind to it, Angus, I can fly so fast that even falcons weep to see me leave them behind."
They said something I couldn't hear. It was too far below, and the wind was already rushing around me. It might have been "suit yourself" or something along those lines, but I hardly cared. Flying was just the thing to lift the shadows from my soul. It was my perfect pleasure, the counterpoint of my existence that stood in opposition to the voice of the void. Flying was a talent that any wizard was technically capable of, but none tried to do it the way I did. Gareth Galen would shape change, others would use a protective construct, but no wizard who wanted to keep living would fly using only their raw ability to shape Aethar. The reason was simple. It was dangerous. Over the past 2,000 years, most wizards who attempted it wound up killing themselves, or at the very minimum acquired injuries that made them rethink their choices. It wasn't hard, but it took practice. Since most learning requires mistakes, and these mistakes were usually fatal, I was the only living wizard who flew this way. I had been unfortunate enough to be trapped in an undead body for a year, and during my time as an immortal, I had taken the opportunity to learn. Crashing into a mountain wasn't so bad when you felt no pain and your body would reform on its own. I shot through the air like an arrow launched from a bow, gaining altitude and speed as I went. When the rushing wind became too powerful, I created a long tapering shield around myself, pointed at both ends. I continued adding speed to my flight. The ground shrank beneath me, and the tops of the trees began to blur. I was already traveling at a velocity that would be fatal if I hit anything, no matter how strong my shield was. I had once discovered that even if you could create a shield that wouldn't break, your body could still be reduced to jelly from the shock. It had taken weeks to fill and level the crater that I'd produced in the yard of Castle Cameron while learning that. It was almost a shame I wasn't immortal anymore. That had been my most memorable landing. Exerting my will, I flew faster still. The sun was devastatingly bright this high up, with few clouds to mitigate its rays. It bathed me in warmth and seemed to thaw my heart. The world below was a rapidly changing vista of trees, rocks, rivers, and mountains. I kept pressing, accelerating even as I added a sonic shield to protect my ears. I knew what was coming. Without my hearing, I only experienced the shockwave as a powerful shiver that passed through my body. I had broken what my son's friend Gary called the sound barrier. According to him, that meant I was moving at somewhere around 740 miles an hour, the usual speed of sound in air. It didn't mean I couldn't go even faster, though. The force of the air against my shield was powerful and intense, creating heat that I was forced to compensate for. It was exhilarating. Even a tiny defect in my shield would rip me apart. Death was close and friendly, patting me on the back as my stomach fluttered with excitement. I pushed harder, my focus absolute, my will harder than steel. For a short time I was a god. Again. It felt magnificent, and I reveled in the power and majesty of the sky as I tore through the firmament. I kept the blistering speed up for almost an hour before I let my pace slacken. Even with my reserves, using that much power to fly was exhausting, not to mention a little foolish. Dropping down to a speed that was probably still several times faster than anything ever managed by one of Mother Nature's creations, I cruised over the world. Having flown many times, I was familiar with the landscape, so I recognized immediately when I was nearing Albemarle. I slowed even more and used the last part of my journey to relax myself, spinning and diving, twisting and flying in loops, enjoying my mastery of the air. Briefly, I toyed with the idea of increasing my speed again before flying over the capital. A sonic boom would probably scare the citizens half to death. Being a grown-up, ostensibly, I dropped the notion as childish. They're lucky I'm so mature, I told myself. Then I imagined what Penny's response would have been to that statement. Good thing she hadn't heard my thought. My first stop was at the office of David Summerfield. It was located across the street from my home in Albemarle. I'd only recently acquired the building he was in, so I could install my factor there with some semblance of dignity. David was a solid man, but he'd suffered a tragedy in the past year. He'd been betrothed to Lily Tucker, my children's nanny and one of our household servants. She'd died trying to stop the kidnapping of my youngest daughter, and while David had managed to forgive one of the culprits, Alyssa, he couldn't bear to live near her. Alyssa was serving as one of my current servants, under a sort of house arrest, and she was pledged to marry Graham Thornbear. It wasn't likely she'd be leaving any time soon. So instead, David had begged me to place him elsewhere. His new job as my factor was something of a step up, but it made a lot of things easier for me. In the past, I'd borrowed the use of Lady Rose Hightower's factor when I needed business conducted in the city, and it had probably been well past time when I should have hired my own factor to manage such things, since I was a grown-up nobleman now, after all. I drifted down slowly, like the leaves on an autumn day, and stepped lightly onto the cobblestones in front of his office. The people on the street looked at me with some amazement, and then recognized me by my clothing as much as my face. They hurried on, keeping their faces pointed firmly at their feet. I rapped on the door once, just to be polite, then let myself in. It was my building. David stood just inside, standing very close to a young woman who didn't look much like a trading partner. In fact, he had his arms around her only a moment before, but he had withdrawn them at my sudden knock. Mage sight was a wicked thing sometimes. It had only been a little over a half a year since Lily's death, but he was a relatively young man with an important job, living alone in the most populous city in Lothian. I shouldn't have been surprised. Everyone deals with grief differently, and I promised myself I wouldn't judge. Barely a half a year and he's already moved on, I thought. Yeah, I was judging, but I was determined not to let it show. Hello, David, I said brightly.
My lord, he exclaimed with only a hint of nervousness. I didn't expect you today.
I felt like getting some fresh air today, and Angus needs more materials for the new work in Hallam, I told him. I figured it wouldn't hurt to run my own errands for a change. Introduce me to the young lady. He took her hand immediately, stepping back and giving a half bow as he presented her.
My Lord Cameron, this is Sarah Beckins, who I have only recently had the benefit of meeting. Sarah, this is Mordecai Eleniel, the Count de Cameron.
He had probably added that recently part for my benefit. I took her hand and brushed my lips across her fingers, barely making contact, as was the custom.
A pleasure to meet you, Sarah.
She blushed and curtsied.
The pleasure is mine, my lord.
It was clear she was not a noble woman, but she was definitely well-mannered. I released her hand and glanced around the room. Making a quick assessment, I asked her, "Do you work at the flower shop down the street?" Her flush became much deeper, and I knew I had hit on the truth. For a moment, I felt like Lady Rose herself with my inductive leap.
Yes, my lord, she answered, stammering slightly. I'm surprised you know of it.
I smiled, hoping to make her more comfortable. I had scared her, scared both of them, and I felt a little guilty for it. Still, I didn't want to waste a good leap of logic.
My house is just across the street, I said casually. Though I don't stay there often, I try to keep abreast of what goes on in the neighborhood.
I let my eyes rest on David. He would be wondering how I had known where she worked, whether I was watching him somehow. He was too rattled to consider the fact that there were flowers set in several occasions around his office, in vases and pots. I had known a small bit about him during his time courting Lily Tucker, and never had I noted any particular love of flowers. Oh, he had brought her flowers on occasion, but these flowers were in his office, and they hadn't been there 2 weeks ago. So, obviously, he had taken to stopping at a flower shop regularly. The easy answer for why was Sarah. The young lady made her excuses and left. Once she was gone, I gave David a friendly look. I like her.
I don't know too many people in the capital yet, he responded somewhat nervously. She's just a friend.
That was a patent lie.